didn't finish my dang on analytics story. You got to go to bed or something? You go get any computer and run what the best shots are. They'll tell you a post-up's worth shot in basketball.
Hey everyone, I'm back with another episode of the Sports on Paper podcast. Once again, I'm joined by some people who entered the Big Data Bowl this year. This is Team O-Snap, and I'll let everyone introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Asma Toomey. I am a data analyst by day and a sports analyst by night.
Hi, this is Tony L. Hobart. Kind of the same boat there. Data analyst by day and like to look at sports at night.
Hey, this is Sydney Robinson. I'm kind of a merge of both. I do sports during the day and kind of at night too, so it's not too bad.
Hey, this is Marshall Furman. I'm a statistician. I do environmental research by day and sports for fun on the side.
Nice. Seems like we all like to play around with data. So this is the first time I've been on with a group, and I think it would be interesting to talk about how you all met and what it was like working together remotely on this sort of project.
I think I texted Ozma and just asked if she wanted to do it, because last year I tried to do it and totally flopped. And then she said, yeah, I have a couple other people in mind. I was like, well, more the merrier, definitely smarter than me. So I think maybe I'll kick it to you as well on how that actually came fully into fruition.
Yeah, I just, honestly, things moved really fast. I remember tweeting about my intention to do the Big Data Bowl because I just felt like I really couldn't call myself a sport analyst if I knew so little about football. And I thought that was such a great opportunity to learn more about it. So I think I had tweeted, you know, I'm looking for team members. And I believe Tony had DM'd me, and I was super ecstatic because Tony and I go back a little bit. We've been involved in some R-specific book clubs during the pandemic, so I knew him a little bit. And again, just super excited to have him on. And then Marshall is a connection through Namita. She used to work for the Eagles. She had a colleague there, James, who was friends with Marshall. So that connection kind of happened organically because Marshall was also interested in the Big Data Bowl and wanted a team. So yeah, that's how we got together, just through Twitter and social media, really. And it worked out really well for us to be on a team for this project, just given how challenging it was, how it demanded different skill sets, which we all bring to the table, you know, when we're all together.
Yeah, what was it like? How did you guys get started working together? You get a dump of data from Kaggle, from the NFL. What does that first look like when you get the data? Is everyone kind of exploring it on their own, or?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So the first thing we wanted to do was get up and running in terms of setting up a collaborative environment. So that involved us, you know, just setting up a GitHub repo with the data and just some folders in place to keep us organized. But sure, yeah, as soon as we, you know, got the data, I think all of us just independently took a stab at it, just some very basic EDA, and then we got on a couple Zoom calls to discuss it, mostly to discuss how overwhelming it is and how we had to sort of split up the tasks in terms of cleaning it and getting some features out of it.
Yeah. How does this kind of data compare to stuff y'all look at outside of sports? I know that this tracking data for the Big Data Bowl is pretty unique in that it's way more granular than you would typically see for like sports, you know, way more than a box score.
Marshall, you work with spatial data every day, don't you?
Yeah, sometimes I do. And so this was, you know, definitely more granular than stuff that I've worked with. And also just like bigger in size, right? I mean, I think there were on the order of like 20 million rows of tracking data here, because it was like every pass play for a whole season. And so that was pretty overwhelming at first. You know, we kind of had to take it in bite-sized pieces, right? Like look at a play, look at a frame of a play, look at, you know, just the part where somebody's throwing the ball, and kind of go from there. And, you know, it definitely did take us a few weeks, each of us kind of on our own and chatting. We had like a Slack group where we could talk about stuff, to really just get a feel for it, before we even started asking any questions.
Cool. What was your level of experience with football data, or I guess football domain knowledge, before this? I know we talked a little bit offline before this about how seems like last year's Big Data Bowl actually required very little domain knowledge to like win or do well, and seems like this year's a big shift from that. Yeah.
Sydney, I think Sydney is probably our subject matter expert in football. You know, I'm a person that played Madden a lot growing up, and I was really I watched a lot of sports growing up. But I guess, you know, probably since college and after college, I haven't watched as much. I'm still, you know, I have fantasy leagues, so I watch it, you know, in part for that. And other than that, maybe just watch, you know, the Sunday night game. But, you know, I feel like playing Madden a lot, and I know people joke about it, but it really can build a pretty good intuition on, you know, play types and all that.
Yeah, I agree. Madden's pretty good. Pretty realistic, I think.
Yeah, and I also think that, I mean, it was definitely harder, I mean, comparatively, but I think, I mean, football, and I think that's some of the challenge. So, like, in basketball, the terminology is pretty similar if you go from team to team. In football, it's not like that at all. And so I think that maybe it was maybe even a good thing, because there's such a high barrier just from team to team, just in terms of football language. So there's the same issue when you talk about data to football. So while it's definitely a challenge, I think it's probably pretty realistic of what the actual like challenges if somebody were to join a front office or a coaching staff in an analytics role or anything else. So I actually think it was kind of a positive challenge, and kind of charged you to think about what, like, very purposefully, what can you do with the data? What can you answer with the data? But maybe even more importantly, like, what are the limitations that without coaching or some certain context specific things that you may or may not even be able to do super accurately.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I mean, you know, I watch football weekly, but I don't know all the ins and outs of it. And so it was definitely a mix of talking to, you know, the teammates and Sydney especially, and also, you know, talking to a friend that works in football and a friend that works in baseball, and just like learning more about, you know, what it is that they know, how they think about problems like this, what would be interesting to them as somebody who's, you know, worked with a team, or, you know, what could they learn from something that we could create? So it was definitely a conversation that had to happen.
Cool. Let's dive into your project. It's called Weighted Assessment of Defender Effectiveness. Good acronym, WADE. after Wade Phillips, I guess.
Yep.
I also like to spend a lot of time coming up with acronyms for metrics that I make. It just makes them more memorable. So I guess segue from what we were just talking about, like talking to other people who have worked with like football data before. I see that you guys like cite other work by previous Big Data Bowl contestants. So that's pretty cool. So does any of you feel free to just kind of describe what this metric is supposed to measure? Why is it better? Why is it good? That kind of stuff.
Well, I don't know if it's better than anything that's out there or privately done, but it is our honest attempt at sort of getting into two skills that we know are important when it comes to defense. Those two skills are first coverage skill, and the second one is contest skill. So if you're to go over our Big Data Bowl submission, you'll see that we've built two models to try to get at those two skill sets. And then we combine them to create a metric that ranks defenders based on those two skills. So that's our work in a sentence or two.
What is coverage skill and what is contest skill?
In the notebook, we go on to describe how coverage skill is what we say is suppressing target probability, and contest skill is suppressing catch probability. There's more factors involved in it, but that's probably the straightforward answer to that.
Cool. So I guess coverage is it relies on a model that tells you like how much receivers can be targeted, right? And you're looking at how individual defenders like change that value, right?
Right. So like the target probability model is kind of the basis of the entire thing, right? Where we assign a probability that to each receiver of them being targeted by the QB. We're kind of assuming the QB is going to make the best decision. We don't really have a separate model for that. We're just assuming they're making the best decision. And so, yeah, you have all those weights for the receivers, and we use a weighting system to assign value to each defender. So it's not just a strict closest defender is given all the credit for suppressing the receiver that they're nearest to. It's based off, inverse distance weighting so that, a defender can get weighting for more than one receiver. It's a kind of a simplistic approach, but it gets around having to come up with coverage labels, whether that's a team coverage label or, individual coverage labels.
Cool. I think that's pretty clever. Figuring out man versus zone and then who is responsible for each receiver seems like a pretty hard thing to do just by itself. So, being able to take a shortcut there seems pretty clever. So, you guys created a bunch of features for this target probability model. How do you decide what features to use, or how are you crafting these features, and what's the process like for testing them, or how do you decide to remove one or add one, et cetera?
Sure. I'll start this off by saying, or by shouting out, Next Gen Stats and the NFL FastStar people for being very transparent about the features that go into their own catch probability models. And we certainly borrowed heavily from them. You'll see that we took a lot of features that they use, and we've also thought long and hard about the tracking data that we had in our possession and try to see what other features we could add that we thought were important for catch probability or target probability.
Yeah, and I'll add on to that and say, so I worked on the target probability model. It was really important to me to have kind of like the whole pipeline, the data processing to the cross-validation to, hyperparameter tuning all there. And then just being able to add or remove columns based off, some predefined list of columns and saying, okay, I want to rerun the whole process and see how it changes, the log loss when you do cross-validation. And also look at, I was also looking at feature importance kind of through every, change of variables just to see how much it changed things. And then that part was pretty subjective, at that point looking at, it landed kind of in the middle of the list of features that were important. So probably keep that. But if it was at the very bottom, then probably, disregard that. At that point, there wasn't really like a cutoff, it had to be in the top 10 of my, ranked variables or anything, or it had to, reduce log loss by a certain number. At that point, it was kind of subjective. But, I would say having the whole model processing pipeline down so that you could rerun everything just by changing a couple of variables and looking at, the model accuracy and all that.
Cool. That makes sense. How did you, what were some of the important features?
So for target probability, we found target share was among the most important. And so, and that's just looking at all the receivers on the field, who which receivers are most targeted during the season. So there is a little bit of a, I'll say this, there's a little data leakage here because we're using, if it's a week one game, we won't know which receiver is actually targeted, the most on that team until like the end of the season. But, we could, theoretically use like past seasons to do this, to generate the same feature. That target share feature. So that's really helpful in the early frames after the snap where, if you don't have a lot of information and given all things equal, the QB is going to throw it to the primary receiver most often. So that's, that came out, I think among the top two variables. The other thing QB orientation really came up among the top of our variables. So that makes sense, right? Like, especially right before they're throwing, the QB is going to be looking at who they're throwing unless they're, Mahomes. So that's an important feature.
Interesting. Do you know what would happen if you removed that target share variable? I feel like there's kind of a few ways to interpret what that means, right? Maybe plays are designed for certain players because the coach knows they're good. And maybe the quarterback's not actually finding the most open player or whatever, right? How much worse would things be if you remove that feature?
So, yeah, I didn't actually have that feature initially. Sydney was the one that suggested it after we kind of, it was a preliminary model and preliminary results I was presenting to the team. And the model was much worse. I don't remember exactly how much worse, but, seeing how target share came up amongst the top two, most important features, I just remember seeing the difference and seeing it was a pretty significant difference in terms of model accuracy.
Yeah, but to that point too, though, Tony, I think the amount of EDA y'all did and everybody did was really what I think set up a really strong framework for everything, in terms of variable selection, everything else. To be honest, it's definitely more EDA than I would do on my average project. And I think it served us a lot, but it also really taught me a lot. But I think it made the actual modeling process and everything else a lot more seamless, maybe more than everybody gives credit, maybe not. But to me, it just felt like everybody had gotten so familiar with so many different nuances across the board that when it came to actually model that, people had pretty informed opinions and decisions with football context and without football context about some of what we could expect or not.
Cool. So basically every frame gets a probability for every receiver, right?
Yep.
I'm reading your thing where you say the accuracy on the first, middle, and last frames are within plus or minus 0.5% of the accuracy on all frames. What does that mean? Like there's not much of a difference between which frame you're using, or I didn't know how to interpret that.
It's maybe not the best wording. We're trying to cut down on words there. So for the target probability model, you can't, since we don't know when the ball will actually be thrown, we thought it was, you know, important to kind of calibrate how accurate the model is at any given frame. Target probability is kind of interesting, right? It's valid to have, you know, an independent model just for the snap. But I think for anything after the snap, it really has to be a continuous model. You can't just like train on the frames where the ball was thrown, because that's, I don't know, you're giving the model like too much information there, which is like, yeah. Oh, you know, like in certain plays, they throw it half a second after the snap, and the other plays, it's like 3 seconds after the snap. So it was important to us to check how, you know, accurate the model was at any given point after the snap. So that's what we were trying to show there, that it was pretty accurate, you know, stable across any frame after the snap.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. I really liked the visuals. I will link this Kaggle notebook in the episode notes, but there is basically an animated chart that shows each receiver's target probability on the y-axis and the frame number or time, I guess, on the x-axis. And on top of that, it would actual like dots or players are shown on a football field. So that's kind of cool to look at those side by side and understand or try to reverse engineer like what the model is seeing at each time step. So I thought that was super cool. So y'all used SHAP to interpret features. I think we talked a little bit about features, but do you want to talk about SHAP? Do you guys love SHAP? I kind of love SHAP.
I love SHAP. I think, I don't know. I've definitely read a couple things over the years where it's, I don't know, having a package specific feature importance, you know, it doesn't really resonate with me. If you're using, you know, something that's specific to random force versus, you know, gradient boosting, even though it might seem similar, you really can get pretty different results. So it was important to us to have like a model agnostic method, one that's, you know, backed up by solid theory. But even then we did check it against kind of a XGBoost's, you know, package feature importance, which I think they just have Gini impurity. So we checked it against that and it was like pretty highly correlated with it as well. But yeah, I don't know. In general, I'm a big fan of model agnostic approaches, and SHAP seems to be kind of like the king of things right now.
Yeah, totally a king.
And for us, for the catch probability model, the way you kind of get at variable importance is to see which variables in your model produced so-called useful splits. And so we have a visual in our Big Data Bowl submission showing partial dependence plots. So that's kind of a fancy word to just say, you know, how does our catch probability evolve with the different values of certain variables we used in the model? So our catch probability model was actually split into two submodels. The first one was time of throw. The second one was time of arrival. They both use different variables, but you can see certain ones like distance to nearest defender. You could see that with the distance increasing, the completion probability increases as well, and at certain points plateaus. And you can kind of see the evolution of those catch probabilities with all the variables in the model. So that's how we approached variable importance, and also just seeing which ones, you know, are important to catch probability.
Cool. How do I interpret like the difference between the time of throw model versus time of arrival model for catch probability? So it's basically saying what's the probability the receiver catches the ball at the frame where the quarterback releases, right? That's time of throw. And then time of arrival, it's the same thing except when the ball like gets to the receiver, or?
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. So
what's different about them?
Two separate models. And they were both kind of frozen in time at the time of throw and at the time of arrival. And, you know, there's more information that you have, especially about who's going to catch it or whether they're going to catch it by the time the ball arrives, right? Because it's a lot closer to them. And so we treated them separately so that we could see if there were kind of gains to analyzing it at that point.
Which features changed a lot in importance from these two? Do you know?
Yeah, so when we were looking at the variables that the model split on the most for the two submodels, there were differences there for sure. I do remember that distance to nearest defender was up there for both submodels.
Uh-huh. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. From a human looking at this standpoint. Interesting. Yeah, I like these partial dependence plots. I think it's another interesting way to look at how important these, or yeah, the difference in importance for these variables.
Yeah, that definitely went into our decision to use BART for this one, because we could have easily just used XGBoost for this. But one of the advantages of a BART model is these cool partial dependence plots, which, you know, is good for several reasons. But I think the most important reason for us was just to get a little bit more interpretability. And that's, you know, something that is sometimes lacking from machine learning models, but it is not in the case of BART.
Yeah, I saw you had some tweets about BART. Why do you like BART?
that's the whole podcast now.
That's the whole podcast. We'll have like an hour about the BART love fest, I guess.
You have no idea what can of worms you just opened.
Oh, no. Let's hear it.
I really like BART for a lot of reasons that actually Samir and Kathy went into really well, because BART happens to be sort of a model that Samir is very familiar with. He even created his own BART model. It's a flavor that gets at time varying coefficients, but I'm not going to get into that. That's really complex. But yeah. Yeah,
who's Samir and Kathy?
Oh yeah, sure. So Samir Deshpande, he is a MIT postdoc at their artificial intelligence lab. He knows a lot about causal inference and Bayesian models. And Kathy Evans, she's a biostatistician who works now as the director of analytics for the Toronto Raptors. And they had a really cool submission last year, which we've tried to borrow from and tried to build from. On
2 years ago, right?
2 years ago, yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, 2 years ago, they had a paper on expected hypothetical catch probability. So you'll see that paper mentioned a lot in the submissions this year. But yeah, they had a podcast not too long ago, open source. I think the podcast name is Open Source Sports, I believe. And they went into all the myriad of reasons why BART is a good model to use. And I'll quickly summarize them now. First off, it works sort of out of the box, meaning you don't have to mess with the arguments too much to produce a useful model. Second, you don't have to think too hard about the functional form. You know, you just kind of throw your data in there and see what shakes out. it handles interactions really well, which is something that we knew was going to happen in our model with all the variables that we have. It also handles a large number of variables pretty well. And it gives us these partial dependence plots, which again helps us with interpretability. These plots I like a lot because it's something that, you know, you can show to executives or you can show to a coach and say, you know, just as you know, coach, that distance to nearest defender, that matters to catch probability, right? And the higher the distance, the higher the catch probability. Well, you know, our model shows the same thing. So we thought that was valuable to have. And you know, the competition did stipulate that, you know, a winning submission would have to be actionable and interpretable. So that justifies our choice for going with a BART model for this one.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's pretty important to get a non-quantitative people who make decisions to understand what models are saying. So seems pretty cool. So there's these two models that kind of give like a baseline, one for target probability and one for catch probability. And then the rest of the work is kind of focused on how do we allocate credit to defenders for like suppressing these values, right? How did you all do that? Credit allocation seems to be generally hard problem for a lot of sports analytics. I think about it a lot for basketball, and I think, yeah, it seems pretty difficult for football too. So what were your ideas?
Right. So we use the inverse distance weighting, like I mentioned before. I think we discussed a couple ideas. I don't really know exactly. I don't remember exactly why we kind of concluded that would be the way to go.
How do we calculate inverse distance weighting?
So, okay. Yeah. You take, the distance, you know, between let's say one defender and one receiver and kind of compare that to the distance of every other defender to that same receiver. And so if like one defender is much closer, you know, their weighting is going to be much closer to one. If they're much farther and there's more defenders closer to, you know, a given receiver, their weighting is going to be closer to zero. So I think that kind of summarizes that. But yeah, I think it's so sort of
a, you're summing that. You're summing that over all frames.
Yes, you do that for every frame separately. I mean, I guess if you kind of progress through time, the weightings will, you know, there's a time correlation there. So, you know, if it's 0.9 in one frame, the next frame, it might, you know, move down by 0.01 or something, but it'll be pretty close.
Got it. And then that weight determines how much each player is like penalized, right? Or, you know, if a catch is made or if a target is, if a throw happens toward a receiver, the defender closest to that receiver, based on this weighting scheme, gets the biggest penalty.
Right. And I guess there we're also, you know, taking the difference between like the beginning of the play and the throw. So taking the difference between the weight times the target probability at the snap versus what it is at the throw. And yeah, summing that across every receiver and every defender.
Cool. And I guess this kind of this framework works for both. Both metrics, right?
Right. So for the catch probability, it was a little bit more static because we were looking at individual, you know, the frames at the time of throw or time of arrival. But the same idea, you look at the weights based on how far away all the players are to that receiver that's catching the ball. And you know, like Tony was saying, this was just kind of what we came up with. Definitely, it's a open problem. I think there's a lot of different ways you could look at it. You know, you can come up with like a matchup model for individual defenders. You can use, you know, team coverage types. We also looked at kind of time-based waits, like how long are they closest to the receiver, how long are they the nearest defender, that kind of thing. And this is just kind of what we ended up doing because it was pretty easy to explain and calculate. That was probably the main reason.
Yeah, I think that the matchup model, right, like using kind of like a hidden Markov model to find out, you know, what's the probability of a given defender is covering any given receiver on the play. I think that would have been like what we really would want to do if we had like a ton of time. But it's just, you know, we didn't have enough time and all that.
For sure. Yeah. This reasonable shortcuts are always good. Interesting. So I guess for like the catch probability, a defender like 5 yards away from the play and not the closest defender is also going to get some penalty. Like intuitively, that seems kind of hard to interpret for me because like maybe I can just watch the play and be like, this guy should bear no responsibility if it's just, you know, like straight man-to-man coverage. How do you kind of like explain away some of those things?
Right.
Or do those things like affect the results really? Yeah,
so it's not a perfect system, but you know, I guess in that situation, if it is man-to-man, then they should have been closer than 5 yards away, right? So they do deserve some of the blame when they kept them.
I meant like, say they're like not the closest defender.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. So if they're the second closest.
Yeah, maybe second closest or something.
Yeah, so it's still going to weight the closest one the highest. And it's, you know, we did like the inverse of the distances and squared those values. So it's a pretty steep drop off.
I guess, yeah, it would just be such a negligible weight for the second, like the second closest defender, and man coverage is just going to have a tiny weight, right? Because there's always going to be someone else closer. I guess it'd look very different for zone, right? I'm just kind of thinking out loud. Zone, if a guy passes, the receiver passes through like a few different receivers, maybe you'll get more, kind of more even weighting across defenders.
Well, that, and the other thing to think about is, I mean, so this, the steepness, like, I don't think could be understated, but also, I mean, NFL systems and defenses in general are all, I guess, NFL defenses are systems. And if somebody messes up, that, I mean, that influences the target probability, that influences like everything. So it's really not, like sometimes there can be blame just put on one person, but it's not ever exclusively just one person more often than not. Or when we started to go down the rabbit hole, there were a lot of like one-off, like, well, if this, if that type of situation. So I think everybody's spent a long time, but I can't remember who specifically, but the inverse weighting like ends up being like the best solution because of how like interdependent everybody is essentially.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, my line of critique of like cherry picking examples where it would fail is like probably not the best way to like interrogate a model. Cause yeah, there's always going to be weird edge cases and the model probably isn't going to handle all that kind of stuff. So that's, yeah, I guess the squared weighting would really, fix all those concerns or make them not really concerns. What were the results like? Did you all think that the players that came up high in the target probability over expectation and catch probability over expectation models, like, were they reasonable? Did people who watch football agree, etc.?
I thought so. Everybody I talked to and looking at it myself felt like they were actually pretty strong. Like not necessarily on, I don't know about Twitter, but like just more so like people I had talked to in football and everything else compared to that year, it looked at least at the top, like stacked up pretty well.
Yeah. Right. What do you think about the validity of, you know, using like an eye test to evaluate the results? Like, is that even good process? I don't know. I do it a lot.
I mean, it has to at least pass the sniff test first before you go. I mean, I think if like you look at the eye test and it's like out of bounds, right? Like nothing makes sense at all. Then you're either found something really incredible that nobody else has done before, or more often, more times than not, it's something's not quite right. And I don't think we found the thing that nobody else has found before just yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard people talk, or I saw people tweeting about like Stephon Gilmore being a player you would want near the top. Seems like he's near the top in your results, so that's good.
Yeah, that was a joke. Like, I thought it was kind of just internal to our group, but apparently, like, everyone else kind of had the same thought, where it's like, if you don't have Stephon Gilmore in like the top five or top 10 or whatever, then it's probably something wrong with your approach or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, I guess I would not know that as someone who has not watched NFL very closely. So I guess that's where like domain knowledge is a really good shortcut. So did anyone here who plays fantasy football use these results to like try to pick receivers or something? Feels like something I would do if I saw this. or if this was even early enough in the season. I don't know.
We actually put that in the appendix, a whole paragraph on how you can use this for fantasy. Oh, I'm just kidding.
No. Did anyone use this? No.
I didn't use it for any fantasy, but you know, I was saying to Asma the other day, it definitely affected the way that I watch football now. Because all I can think of is like a pass is thrown and I'm like, okay, what's the catch probability? What are all these defenders doing? Are they moving further away? Crowding them near the sideline, all this stuff. And like that's the whole lens that I view the game through now. So it may affect that kind of stuff moving forward for me.
Nice. Does that increase your enjoyment of watching sports or decrease it?
Definitely both. Because part of watching sports is to enjoy it and to relax. And so you don't want to be overthinking it. And, you know, I don't really have a stake in their results at all. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I have a metric that likes a weird player and I see the weird player do good things, I'm just like, oh wow, look how smart I am. Like I found something that people didn't see, but obviously I realize it's not necessarily a good process. Just cherry picking the times that the players you like do well. So
I was gonna say like rankings can be kind of interesting, right? Like you do want to have like good players among the top, because that just to match intuition, but like, you kind of want to have some interesting results in there to show like, oh, your model's, you know, finding something different. It's providing a competitive edge. So there's definitely like an interesting nature to like creating rankings.
Totally. How do you translate like these numbers and your results to, I don't know, winning or like win probability or. I don't even know what other metric you could use, but like I see, you know, Kyle Fuller minus 20.3 for DPOE, DTPOE. Like, what does that mean? Like, how do I read that?
Well, I think it comes down to roster construction is one part. I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to use it, but our stat is, I would say, more descriptive than it is necessarily predictive. Just the way we trained the model, because given the scope of data and everything, we weren't trying to necessarily predict future. You could now go and train, like run it for next year and it would work, but it just really wasn't the way we implemented it. So, I mean, but I think looking back at the year, I mean, you can know what guys you need get, like if you need a guy to help just shut down a side of the field or mitigate at some level, now you have an evaluation of that. And if you have a guy who's better in coverage and is gonna allow somebody who's gonna shut down the field to then pressure other parts of your defense, and this is a super oversimplified version or like explanation, but it allows you to kind of pull levers as a decision maker in front office to understand what are your needs and where can you get somebody that might be overvalued or undervalued for what you can get them at salary wise.
Yeah, I would say the numbers themselves are, you know, admittedly not really the easiest to interpret. They're just kind of summed probability, you know, summed weighted probabilities over the course of the year, you know, whatever that means, right? We didn't want to get into, you know, maybe multiplying this by expected points added or something that just, you know, introduces kind of more error, and you kind of need you need an EPA model for non-targeted receivers. It just gets a little beyond what we wanted to do. But, you know, I think it, like Sydney was saying, taking the rankings, looking at those and looking at that as like a, you know, descriptive perspective on the season to help you kind of construct your roster, you know, going forward. I think that's what I would take away from it.
Nice. Intuitively, what do you think about this metrics, like year to year correlation, if you had another season of data? Of the same data, like, do you think the top players would be near the top still? Does aging play a big part, or is there a lot of small sample luck? What do you think? What do y'all think?
I would guess that it's probably a similar, like, year over year R squared that like CPOE or EPA has for like QBs. That's just my.
I don't know about football stuff.
I think that's around like, you know, 0.3 or 0.4. Don't quote me on that. So it's not zero, but it's also not one. It's hard to know how much of that's, you know, I guess probably the 0.3 or 0.4 R squared is kind of telling you there's definitely some skill involved, but there's a lot of other factors that go into it as well.
Yeah, and I think it would work really well in some ways, right? Because you could see players that maybe haven't hit their peak yet, and then they, you know, start to get better year to year. Players that are kind of in their prime, you know, maintaining, and you know, you'd also probably see some players that teams may see, you know, them further down on this list and start to take advantage, and then you know, you see big drops year over year. So I think there would be a wide range of outcomes for sure.
Cool. What would you do next if you had more time with the same data or more data?
I can try and take it, mostly because I flopped on my end. I was looking at like some correlated random walk stuff. So basically, how can you simulate out a player's projected path over the course of a play? And then even especially like how players break on the ball, how their hips turn, everything, because correlated random walk stuff, you can do a lot in terms of like their movements and turning and agility from maybe the non-traditional. I mean, you can do the tradition, some of the traditional athleticism, like north-south speed, but also in terms of like evaluating how fast players are able to turn up the field or how quickly they can react in some of the what I'll call non-traditional athletic ability. So being able to simulate out what the a specific player is most likely to do. And then I think the next step is, and kudos to Ron and everybody on the ghosting, is try to figure out what the optimal path would be for a player. And so if you take the difference between those two, you can see basically, and you can, whatever, you can choose a bunch of different things as your target for optimal, right? EPA, it could be completion percentage. I mean, there's a million things, but kind of doing something with that in a, I guess it's more ecologically based, which has no merit on anything, but in terms of valid or invalid methodologies, but something that looks at like the true natural part of the movement of players and their effectiveness with it.
What about y'all?
I think on the catch probability end, it'd be cool to build in more non-targeted player stuff. So, you know, Tony did a good job with the target probability models because they had, you know, values for targeted receivers and non-targeted receivers. For the catch probability, we mostly just looked at the, you know, the passes that were actually thrown. And I think it'd be cool if we could build on some of the work that Samir and Kathy did and look more into, you know, other options that weren't necessarily the observed pass and see if you could, you know, look at that framework and flip it around to look at the defensive impact and see which defenders really were in position to make the right play, but the ball just didn't go their way.
Cool, that makes sense. Yeah, I think that's a pretty natural extension of that. If there's another big data bowl next year, which there probably will be, what data sets would you want? What do you kind of dream of having access to?
This might be a different question, or a different answer. It's like, I think what we'll see probably is, you know, linemen, line play, you know, how you grade all that. You know, I know ESPN did a lot of work on that this past year. I guess that's what I'm kind of expecting. You know, if we were to kind of do the same big data bowl prompts here, I really wish we had, like, you know, team labels, team coverage labels, you know, across all weeks. I think that would be really great for at least target probability.
Yeah, those labels seem like pretty important. Either either someone comes up with a like standardized model for that, or maybe just use humans to watch plays or something. I guess it would start with humans watching stuff to get labels, but I feel like that's important too. Each place, or like man and zone, are just so different. I don't know. Intuitively, seems hard to try to like combine those plays to get player skill ratings, I guess. Or like someone can be good at man and bad at zone or something. Yeah.
Even like if we had QB progression, like if we actually knew what their reads were on a play, like which receivers they were supposed to throw it to, that would help immensely with the, you know, credit allocation, right? Like, oh, they were supposed to, you know, read receiver on the right hand side, but they ended up throwing it to the left side because of the coverage there. You know, that would be awesome. I just don't know. We're not going to get that.
Wow, that would be a whole different level of granularity. That would be insane. What, interview every quarterback and ask them what they saw on every play or something? That would be wild. That would be cool, though. I think maybe a team could do that for themselves. Just get a whole new set of data, try to find some edges to take advantage of. Do you think teams with this type of data are building similar models or doing similar things to measure defensive backs? These players seem very hard to measure in, you know, box score metrics. So what do you think about teams using this stuff?
I volunteer Sydney.
Me? I was going to volunteer Ozma because she hasn't. I would imagine there's some of that. I mean, they're definitely doing forms of it. I think it kind of depends on the problem they're solving, but I think Ozma might have some insight and opinions too on it.
Yeah, I think rankings in general do serve their purpose in a team, but not as much as it does just for entertainment value on our end on Twitter or social media. I think it's different priorities, and I could for sure see a team using a ranking when it comes to wanting to make a trade and just identifying the good players that are still out there that would fit their system. But I'd like to think teams really dig deeper than that, than just a ranking.
And also, yeah. I think we're going to see a lot more of it now that the big data bowl happened, and a lot of people, you know, open source their code and what they did. And so I think there's all kinds of target probability, catch probability models that are out there now that, that people can learn from and hopefully incorporate into their decision-making stuff. So
nice. I wonder if we could take public data now and learn from this tracking data. You know, find some other public information that is correlated with what has been found with the tracking data. I think that might be a way to advance public analytics. Asma, this one's for you. You're big in the hockey analytics world. What are some of the transferable analytics things between hockey and football?
Yeah, they're vastly different sports, but, you know, I came into this wanting to learn more about football, which I certainly have, but I'll just say from a technical standpoint, there's a lot of overlap in the sense that hockey does have tracking data as well. It is big data. It is hard to wrangle. You need to have different skill sets, one of them being know how to deal with spatial data, with temporal components. So I think those are the parallels I would draw between the two, but they are very different sports. There's also lots of parity in both sports. So I think, you know, some of the things people should think about is how to squeeze competitive advantages or try to get an advantage by analyzing this data. And one of the things that I wanted to do in hockey, and I think if I have more time, I could do in football, is to look at penalties. That was one of the things that we were thinking of doing with the Big Data Bowl early on, but we decided not to because the sample sizes were too small over one season. But that could also be another idea for the Big Data Bowl organizers to maybe create like a second competition stream where we could take a stab at penalties, just because I think they do have a big impact on the game, just as it does in hockey.
Can you elaborate on that? What do you mean by penalties? Like in this data set, there was data for like a play with pass interference or something, right? Or no?
We had some stuff in this year about DPIs and so forth, and there was even a question on Kaggle. Let me pull it up right now. That asked. Well, I can't find it now, but that was one of the questions that the Big Data Bowl suggested to people, is to look at the impact that a penalty might have, or what sorts of things can predict a penalty. And I think that's really interesting, because I think not only do teams interrogate themselves about that, but also the league as a whole, given just how impactful they could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point about that area of the game. I feel like is pretty underexplored.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, people just filter it out of a data set or something, because as you said, small samples, don't right. want to look at. Interesting. Do you have any theories or intuitions about what we might find if we looked at that more?
Yeah, I think there may be some stuff on the tracking data that could predict whether a certain type of interference might be called, maybe some player-specific information as well, just, you know, height, weight, skill level, etc. But that's something that, you know, given how little football knowledge I had before, and certainly I've gained some, but not enough to really dig into penalties. But that's something that I'd like to understand better, just because I think it's, again, pretty impactful in a game. Lots of people are wondering about it. And I think also from a fan perspective, you know, whenever there's a penalty call that's controversial, I mean, like, Twitter is set ablaze, right? So it would be cool to try to understand why these things are happening and how they're impacting the game.
Yeah, totally. Football Twitter is definitely very vocal from what I've seen about penalties that change the game a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Is there anything I should have asked about this project that I did not? I know we've talked about a lot of other stuff now too, but just circling back.
Our color schemes.
Color schemes?
Yeah, I was going to say that too.
Yeah, so since audio is not the greatest medium for discussing color, I will attempt to describe what I'm looking at here. On the Kaggle notebook, everything is kind of like purplish. Positive numbers are dark. Do you all not like red and green, or what's the thinking here?
Again, we knew this was a competition, and so you gotta just, you know, try and differentiate yourself to the best of your ability, try to make things memorable a little bit. And so, you know, we knew that aesthetics were important. And so, you know, we had a pretty heated discussion on Slack about what sort of colors we should stick to for our plots and our tables. And we ended up picking this palette from the Psycho package. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but I'm going to spell it just in case people are curious. It's an art package spelled S-C-I-C-O, maintained by Thomas Peterson, and specifically it is the Berlin palette, and I use it so much now, really, and also my actual work, that it's sort of become my brand a little bit, this pink and this dark bluish color that I think go together really, really well.
Yeah, I like the visuals a lot. I'm very bad at data viz. So it's always cool to see things that are pleasing to the eye. Were there disagreements about the color? Did other people not like it?
No, it's sort of become a joke. It wasn't really a fight. It was more like we're doing this palette, and then sort of everyone gets in line as as they
do. It was like,
at the very least, like, yes, ma'am, we're agreeing with that. Oh, go ahead, Tony.
Oh, I was saying, you know, Asma suggested it, and we're like, yes, ma'am.
I know I have no taste, so to me, it meant nothing. Anything above my suggestion was a better idea.
Okay, well, I'm gonna monitor y'all's Twitters, and whenever you tweet stuff in the future, I'll be looking for this this color palette.
Awesome. You won't find it from me.
maybe there's a Python version too, and I can learn from this. It's pretty cool. Cool. Well, if there's nothing else, it was great talking to y'all about your project and a bunch of other random analytics things. Yeah, I feel like I learned a decent amount about different ways to capture the impact of defensive backs. So thank you all.
Thanks. Good chatting.
Yeah, it was good talking.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Bye.
Bye-bye.